I will not sit on the next two cases on the docket. Justice Goodwin will preside.
Please call the next case, Ms. Clark.
Byrne versus City of Alexandria, Warner R. Young III, Appellants Counsel, Amy E. Miller, Martin J. Amundson Jr., Appellees Counsel. Parties, please note that Chief Justice Lemons will not be participating in this case. Senior Justice Russell will be participating. Mr. Young, are you connected and can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. Ms. Miller, are you connected and can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. Justice Goodwin, can you hear both counsel?
Yes, I can.
Justice Mims, can you hear both counsel?
Yes, I can.
Justice Powell, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Kelsey, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice McCullough, can you hear both counsel?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Justice Chafin, can you hear both counsel?
Yes.
Justice Russell, can you hear both counsel?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. Justice Goodwin, the parties are ready to proceed.
All right. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. This is Warner Young on behalf of Thomas Byrne, who is the homeowner and the initial petitioner in this case, which was an appeal from the Board of Architectural Review for the City of Alexandria to the City Council. And then having lost at both of those proceedings, the appeal to the circuit court. I will address the two issues in the case this morning, the motion, the granting of two orders. One, the city's motion craving order, OIR, and two, the demur, granting of the demur with prejudice. These come before the court on a de novo review of those orders. The motion craving OIR and the order granting it was contrary to the law. First, there was no statutory authority for the granting of the motion craving OIR, as OIR was abandoned by the legislature in 1977 with the repeal of Section 8-105 of the code. So there is no statutory authority for the motion craving OIR. At that time, the legislature noted that there was no longer any need for a statutory reference because the concept of those was taken care of by the appropriate rules of court. If you examine the rules of court that existed at that time and that it still exists to today, there is no reference in this court's rules of court to a motion craving OIR. There has been repeated call in certain quarters for an amendment of those rules, and particularly an amendment of Rule 3.7, to include such a motion, but that has not been done. So as of today, there's no statutory authority, and there's no Supreme Court rule authority.
Kelsey, if I may interrupt you, no statute and, as you say, no rule of court, but craving OIR is a common law process. It's not a statutory process, and obviously there were no rules of court under English common law. And we interpreted craving OIR in the Culpeper case in 1937 quite broadly. In fact, we said, quote, no intelligent construction of any writing or record can be made unless all the essential parts of such paper or record are produced, end quote. And we said that in the context of a craving OIR that brought the entire record of a former suit into the breast of the court. So isn't there a common law basis for craving OIR, and why isn't it as broad as Culpeper says?
Two reasons. First, yes, there is a common law history, and there is substantial precedent, most of which occurring before 1900. But let's move ahead to what happened in Culpeper. Culpeper was decided about 40 years after Langhorne, and Langhorne articulated at that time a general rule that craving OIR was only supposed to apply to certain specialties, which included probate and matters of administration, as well as what was then referred to as deeds, and at that time, deeds meant sealed instruments. So that was the enunciation of the the common law history as of 1895, those were the categories governed by common law. In 1937, when Culpeper was decided, it was decided in the context of a case involving a prior litigation of a matter of estate administration. It fit within the specialties articulated by the Langhorne Court. Moreover, what happened in that case is that the plaintiff had only attached a part of a document and had incorporated that into his complaint. However, he left out the other parts. In the context of this case, which fit into the category of cases for which Oyer was appropriate, this court, the Supreme Court, did articulate that if there were documents that were provided that were incomplete, it would be inappropriate for a party to hide those documents and was required to produce them in their entirety. So that is true. However, there's nothing in the Culpeper case which changed the general rule articulated by this court in Langhorne. It neither overturned Langhorne, nor did it articulate any additional categories of documents which would apply to the Oyer document or your doctrine. So that is really the standing of the law as of 1937. The critical change really occurred in 1950, and that was in the passing of modern pleading and adopting the notice pleading. And as we set out in our brief, that's been done in two stages, both in 1950 and then again in 1977. And those have changed the emphasis of pleading to state the essential facts, and is it sufficient to put the defending party on notice? Prior to 1950, we still operated in Virginia as a common law pleading state. And in common law, there were many rules, many types of procedural devices to contest pleadings. And variances in pleadings and proof were fatal to cases. The emphasis was on the pleading. If you look at the historic context of Oyer, that was part of that historic context. It was...
May I interrupt you again, counsel, with this question? But common law can't be set aside by implication. A rule of court or a dispositive decision by the highest court or a statute can displace common law, but not by inference. What is it in notice pleading principles that have expressly displaced the common law remedy of craving Oyer?
Well, if I can say that if we look at Langhorne, the common law as it was enunciated by the court, and as you point out, cannot be changed by inference, was pretty clear. The common law rule was that it only applied to probate, letters of administration, and sealed instruments. So in my view, that position has never changed. However, with the adoption of common law...
Counsel, it changed almost immediately in the Grubbs case, which is 1897, 2 years after Langhorne, which applied craving Oyer to unsealed documents. And then, of course, Culpeper comes along and takes the entire record of a former suit, not individual documents within it. So isn't the common law principle simply being applied to new and different procedural circumstances, but the underlying principle being the same?
The underlying principle is, I think, what gives me pause. The underlying principle was, at that stage, the inclusion of a set of documents into a pleading was something that could be done by Oyer as a predicate for filing demurs with prejudice. The whole notion of notice pleading has been to back away from that type of proceeding, to not eliminate cases at the early stage based on variances between pleading and proof, not to require strict standards. So in my view, the application of Oyer today is substantially different after we adopted notice pleading. The Grubbs case really dealt with the issue of a sealed instrument. If the read of Grubbs does not expand, in my view, the application of Oyer to other types of cases that were articulated in the Langhorne case. Culpepper, again, it is a prior proceeding of a probate administration, but that was one of the categories of cases articulated by the Langhorne court. So it did not expand the categories. It is important, and the VADA's amicus brief articulated the notion that there was a special understanding of the word deeds at common law. And deeds included things like sealed contracts. Interestingly, when the VADA suggests that we now need to eliminate, we can look at contracts or other documents, they say we shouldn't have to look at whether something was sealed. However, at the time those decisions were made, that was critical to the application of Oyer. So we would be not only expanding the categories, but we would be expanding them to documents that were never contemplated because they aren't within the categories and they aren't sealed. That's the bigger problem with Oyer. In this particular case, there's a much more specific problem. The specific problem in this case is, contrary, again, to what the VADA has cited, the 2018-19 version of the civil bench book, as establishing the recognized rule stating the motion craving lawyer seeks an order from the court that the adversary produce a governing instrument. In this case, the adversary was not asked to produce a governing instrument. The city asked that an instrument that it prepared that was solely within its ability to put together that record, to decide what was and what was not part of the record, and that was required to be attached to its adversary's complaint, not produced by the adversary. Mr. Byrne was not asked to prepare a record or to identify a particular document upon which the proceeding was going to be governed. The city produced the document and asked the court to enforce that it had to be read into Mr. Byrne's complaint or petition. In this case, that presented a couple of problems. First, we know from just the problems we had with the joint appendix, two pages were apparently not copied at some point, and we had to file a motion to have those two pages added to the record. So that at the time of review, the court may or may not have had a complete copy of what the city said was its record. That is an inherent problem when you don't have an adversarial process where both parties had perhaps copies of a document. That's one. More importantly, if you read those two omitted pages, there is a reference in those to photographs produced by Mr. Byrne. And if you examine the entire record that is before the court in the joint appendix, those photographs are not included. It is acknowledged in those two pages, and that's joint appendix, the supplemental joint appendix pages A and B, it is acknowledged that he submitted additional photographic evidence which he wanted to be part of the record, and it is in fact not part of the record. In the city's brief, they acknowledge that Mr. Byrne filed a memorandum. That is not part of the record in this case. So in this case, this is not asking someone to produce the contract that they are relying on to support their claim, or it's not asking them to produce the deed upon which their claim is based, or a policy of insurance or anything else. It is asking him to produce, as part of his complaint, a document which he never had, and it was never even in existence until after the petition was filed. The first time that record was ever seen was when the motion for Oyer was filed. So that is a fundamental problem in this case. But I think what it does is it sets out clearly what some of the problems that we can anticipate would happen with Oyer if it is applied across the board to any document. If you examine carefully the VADA brief, you would see that they articulate in that three different standards throughout the brief itself for what the documents are. There are claims that it is excuse me.
Counsel, you have a minute and a half left.
Thank you. In this case, I should move ahead and discuss the demur. If you disapprove of the OIR, you do not have to reach the issue of the demur. If not, you do. If you reach the issue of the demur, I would ask that particular attention be paid to what the court did with respect to the interpretation of the underlying record. Number one, the constant use within the record of the definition of the gate as pedestrian. This is true despite the fact that the city acknowledges, we do recognize that Mr. Byrne did not say that this walk or gate was for pedestrian use, and yet the entire review by the Board of Architectural Review focused on use. Secondly, Mr. Byrne produced historic photographs. Those were ignored. Mr. Byrne produced photographs that are referenced in the record but don't appear in the record. They were not taken into consideration. The claim under the demur, or under the petition, was that the actions of the board were arbitrary and capricious. That is a valid petition and a valid complaint, and standing alone articulates a cause of action. Those things do indicate that there were, in fact, parts of this which were arbitrary and capricious. That is even contained within the record that was produced on Oyer. So, quite frankly, this is a case that needed to have the development of a record. It needed to have the questions properly asked that would be asked during the discovery process about the completeness of the record, the context of it, what was there, what was missing. Those things would have been flushed out, and these ultimately would have been issues decided by the court. This is a issue of law for the trial court to decide, but it would have been after we had a full record, and then the court could have made a proper determination, and this court would have had
a
full record. Yes.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I apologize for running over.
May it please the court, Amy Miller on behalf of Appalese, City of Alexandria, and the City Council of Alexandria. The granting of OIR was legally correct in this case, and the policy reasons for retaining OIR generally are just as relevant today as they have been for the last 200 years. I'd like to address first council's arguments about the lack of a statute or rule. There are many other long-standing devices in Virginia, such as the motion in limine, that are deep-rooted in Virginia common law but are not found in the statutes. It is true that OIR is recognized as a judicial practice in the Virginia Civil Bench Book, and the commentary for why OIR was removed from Section 8-105 that council referenced is actually helpful and explains this point precisely. It says, quote, the portion of the statute that relates to proffert and OIR is taken care of by appropriate rules of court and the procedure for discovery. Therefore, it is repealed as being unnecessary. And so, and that's straight out of the report of the Virginia Code Commission in 1977. So in other words, what was in the statute was duplicative of what Rule 415 already provides. And Rule 415, of course, provides for motions practice generally, but does not list any particular type of motion, much less every type of motion. So just like OIR, for example, motion in limine is not mentioned in the rules or statute, but it's certainly a valid device in Virginia, and it does not mean that that the motion is any less valid or useful. I would also point out that if the legislature intended to abolish it, it would have treated OIR similar to how it treated demur to evidence and plea and abatement in Section 8.01-276. Culpeper National Bank is certainly the primary reason supporting OIR today in the common law. any confusion or any question whatsoever that may have resulted from Langhorne was fully resolved in Culpeper National Bank, where the documents Cray Doyer in that case were certainly not probate documents. It was a probate case, but the documents Cray Doyer specifically were the complete record in a previous lawsuit, which is the case here. And as this court explained in Culpeper National Bank, it provides the law of the land in Virginia on Oyer, not only the law of it, but the reasons for it. It says no intelligent construction of any writing or record can be made unless all essential parts of such paper or record are produced. A litigant has no right to put blinkers on the court. And it says when a court is asked to make a ruling upon any paper or record, it is its duty to require the pleader to produce all material parts. So when the court is asked to make a ruling upon any paper or record, it's not just a good and useful thing. It is the court's duty to require the pleader to produce all material parts. While it's true, as counsel points out, that in the Culpeper National Bank case, the plaintiff attached only a portion of the record, the bigger issue that the court seemed to raise is that the plaintiff asked the court to accept his characterization of the proceedings. And that's essentially what Mr. Byrne is doing here. He complains that he showed pictures to the BAR, but they didn't consider them, and that the BAR and the city council said certain things on the record regarding parking as a factor. And he essentially asked in his petition for appeal, he asked the court to accept his version of the former proceedings. But there is a video and written transcript of those proceedings, which reflects precisely what the BAR and city council did or did not say. And so it is certainly appropriate to look at that record where we've done here. And in particular, this case is appropriate because it is a petition for appeal. The appeal is made under Section 10-107B of the Alexandria Zoning Ordinance. This implements the requirements of Virginia Code Section 15.2-2306, which allows localities to enact ordinances and enforce those issues. But the right of appeal is to the City Council first, and then to the appropriate circuit court of Virginia. And
now,
so,
Justice Kelsey, if I may ask you this, going back to the point you made just a moment ago, Oyer brings the document before the court on demur, but the plaintiff still has the capacity and the ability to say, you know what, that's what the document claims it says, but that's not what happened in fact. So doesn't the point have to be qualified a little bit that even the Oyer gets the document before the court, the pleader still can make within the realm of reasonable inferences the assertion that the documents misrepresent the truth? Now, I know your point in response to that is, well, these documents make it irrefutable, and that may very well be true. But the qualification still exists, does it not?
So the device of Oyer does not necessarily mean that a demur would be granted, for example, which I think is part of your question. Certainly, what Oyer does is that it allows the court to test the merits of the allegations. So whereas here, Mr. Byrne bases his petition solely on the allegation that the BAR and the city council improperly considered a certain factor in the record, but on the other hand, opposes review of that very record so the circuit court can see for itself whether that allegation is consistent with the record. The helpful thing that Oyer does is it allows the court to, on the one hand, accept facts in the light most favorable to plaintiffs, but it also determines if there's a viable claim. It compares the factual allegations to the document upon which those allegations are based. and where the factual allegations are not even consistent and in fact contradict the very documents they purport to characterize, then that may weigh in favor of not having a viable claim. It is just a hopeful
second qualification, is it not? I mean, the contradiction has got to be more than an inconsistency. It's got to be a dispositive inconsistency over which no rational fact finder could possibly disagree. Am I right there?
That would be a fair characterization. Yes, the device of Oyer does not take away the judge's duty to determine if there is a viable claim based on the allegations and whether they state a claim. It is simply a device to test the factual allegations concerning a document against that document, if that's helpful. I think we'd also point out that the emphasis, the revived interest and expanded interpretation of Langhorne truly is unwarranted for the very reasons that were spoken by the bench. This was an 1895 case. There have been numerous occasions, both before and after Langhorne, where this court has favorably recognized Oyer as a useful device. And whether it was granted or denied, or whether granting resulted in dismissal or not, certainly this court has been aware of the many different types of documents that Oyer has been used in and has not criticized or limited its use in that respect. The Virginia Association of Defense Attorneys amicus brief provided an excellent list of at least 32 reported cases in which the Virginia Supreme Court reviewed appeals of circuit court cases where Oyer motions go beyond deeds or letters of probate, and again, did not comment that Oyer was inappropriate or potentially problematic. I'd like to make just a couple of responses to counsel's concern about the propriety of the legislative record. First, there was nothing disputed about any of the contents of the legislative record in this case in the circuit court proceedings. Even Mr. Byrne argued in that court that the record was relevant evidence, and in his opposition to the craving Oyer did not identify specific documents that were incorrect or were missing. Even so, the record simply consisted of eight components of the two proceedings of the BAR and the city council. There were two sets of minutes, two sets of transcripts. There were two sets of dockets. And then there was simply the application in the city staff report. And that was it. The clerk of the city of Alexandria also certified the record with no objection from opposing counsel, and the clerk has this authority under the city code. Even if there were defects, which there were not here, the common law has certainly developed rules for handling those types of objections to the legislative record in land use cases. And that can include supplementing the record, and the court would take the record as it comes up. I believe that counsel may have conflated a missing page in the joint appendix with anything that was incomplete in the legislative record. All the missing page says that was agreed by joint appendix would be submitted to this court is that Mr. Byrne presented some photographs of other gates in front of the curb cuts. The city council, the record clearly reflects that the city council looked at them. They were not handed up until a city council hearing. And so there was certainly no prejudice. And in fact, in the circuit court opinion, Judge Kemmler acknowledges the existence of that and also makes some substantive comments about the photograph, the fact that it was received and considered by the city council. and pointed out that the record reflected that there was ample evidence for accepting the city staff's view of the photograph as opposed to as to Mr. Byrne's view of the photograph. Judge Kemmler granted the motion craving order in open court after oral argument, after hearing argument from both sides. The demur she took under advisement, and there was
counsel. You have 2 minutes left.
Thank you. And there was supplemental briefing on that point. It certainly does not follow that just because a craving, a motion for craving order was granted, that the demur would be granted. And likewise, we disagree with counsel's characterization that if this court rejects the craving order in this case, then the demur must be overruled as well. There were alternate grounds presented for the demur, including that the entire legislative record could have been taken judicial notice of. That was argued in open court and in the briefs. Certainly the Titan America versus Riverton case of this court refers to taking judicial notice of other proceedings upon which the plaintiff bases his right of action, which occurred here. And certainly the record contents are publicly available on the website, and the transcripts were certified in writing by the court reporter. And certainly under Rule 2.201, judicial notice of adjudicative facts, that legislative record certainly could have come in at the demur stage as well. If there are no other questions, I believe we've covered the points raised by opposing counsel, and we would ask this court to affirm the decision by the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Please call the next case.